My name is John Muller. I'm a moderator for the forum this evening. The subject, as announced, is the nuclear arms as the way to peace. Now, it's obvious, I guess, to you, at least I would hope it is to me, that that's one of the number of ways that are proposed as ways to peace. There's an assumption behind this, and that is that peace is desirable. And I'm assuming that that's not an issue that we're talking about tonight, but it might be. The forum, as I understand it, is a place where we can get a chance to talk about some of the things that we have feelings about, that we have wonderments about. It's my understanding that it is not necessarily focused only with the narrowness of the topic, in that you only can speak to that one side, but that there are a number of things that are issues that are related to it. I'm sure that there are a lot of things that have been talked about. I've heard such things as that the way to peace has to include such things as economic development that is non-exploitive of nations who are in the third world or in the fourth world. That there needs to be some sense of justice on the part of those individual nations who make up this world in which we live. That there has to be some sense of both boundary integrity and national security on the parts of peoples. There needs to be some peacemaking mechanisms that are functional. Listening to Roger Molander a couple weeks ago in Washington, I heard him say that one of the things that drives him is the feeling that he does not believe there is anything in place that can deal with the problem of an escalating situation such as the Falklands represent as a picture to us. The questions include also, I think, the will for peace by nationals, you know, whether they think and believe that peace is a way to accomplish what they have. The place and the role of the Church International and its community. My hope is that if there are any of these subjects or others that you would wish to address, please do so. We are in the middle of a week in which there's a lot of that data being fed in through the courses, which I think are classes which are very helpful to us. So if you wish to speak, I hope that, I don't know if there's anybody around on the other side of that. No. Because if I can't see somebody, if I'm missing somebody, I would appreciate it very much if you could help me see. So, we are ready for our discussion of the evening.
Okay. I'm just starting it off.
Okay. You're saying that you have heard that the economic issue is an important one and we do have to get at it.
Yeah, I think it was in Earth Keeping, maybe, or something.
Yeah. Okay, let's mark that as an issue. The other one I don't want to see forgotten about that, and that is the issue of the presence of great numbers of nuclear weapons armed and ready to fire.
What was your title?
The title was The Reduction of Nuclear Arms, the Road to Peace.
But you advocate that?
Beg pardon?
Is that what you're advocating?
No, I don't believe it's possible. Because I think politically, I put a title there, not because I believe it, because I think it's an issue we ought to talk about.
And you don't think that's possible?
I do not.
I'd be interested in hearing a little bit of this.
I don't think the military is going to give it up. Of any nation, including ours. Unless there is a tremendous groundswell of public opinion that will make the politicians curb the military. That's my understanding. And I kind of feel with Roger Molander that the issue that, at least as far as I'm concerned in, that I'm dedicating my life to is trying to get people into some kind of a state of awareness to share what they feel with the politicians. Because if we don't bring that pressure to bear, I see no way that we're going to. My assumption is that the whole arms development is going to proceed and is proceeding, including chemical war. I think all that stuff is under development. It's not under production, to my knowledge. And I don't think any of that's going to stop. Now, that's where John Mueller is, for what it's worth.
I'm sorry, John. What did you said you don't think what will happen?
I do not believe that under the present circumstances we're living in a world where that anything presently is in position that would make possible a reduction in military arms, including nuclear. I don't see it. Thank you. Yes.
I don't agree with that, but I don't think we can have peace unless we don't have the bombs. I mean, we can have a world without war, and that's one thing, but I don't think that's peace. If we have that world only because there are bombs that will blow us up if we do anything, we aren't at peace. We're at just a stalemate. The war is actually on. If we have bombs that are taking people's food in order to be, and that's what bombs do, then we are at war. We're fighting hunger and losing, I guess. But we are at war, so anytime we have nuclear bombs, we are not at peace. So we can't have bombs and peace.
Okay. In California, folks,
that's okay, go ahead.
Well, in California, some of the physicians have taken out newspaper and saying that there's no way that we can take care of people if there is a nuclear bomb today.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, try to get some discussion argument going here. There certainly are people who would agree with you, John, that this is an exceedingly difficult kind of problem, and some would even be either cynical or realistic enough, depending on how you look at that, you think that the only hope of humanity might be that a nuclear bomb or two would go off by accident somewhere, or there would be somehow a little limited war somewhere. In a footnote in one of Robert Johansson's writings, he says that if there is any silver lining to the cloud of the spreading of these weapons across the world, is that it could happen that a couple of little countries that have only a few little bombs might obliterate each other and wake up the human race, kind of the way the Three Mile Island thing began to wake up some people there. Now, that's a rather grim outlook. Others would say the position for social responsibility are doing a service for us, enable us to see the consequences before the fact instead of after.
Okay. Jerry?
Well, I kind of agree with you, John, that I think that it's unlikely the military of any country will voluntarily relinquish these weapons or even agree to slow the pace of their development. But I do think that there's a good chance that the people of the world will insist upon that. And I think we see some evidences of that in the past year or two. I think that even in totalitarian societies, there is some, the governments have to be, to some extent, responsive to their people. And I guess that's what I think these kinds of things are all about. The physicians for social concern are a very important group in generating that kind of movement, because they have a lot of credibility with a lot of people. I had a friend in Helena, Montana, who said his daughter just came home, a teenage daughter just came home from the major clinic there after having some immunizations, and the doctors gave every one of their patients a paper to take home. It was mine that they would give to their parents, said, "Your daughter is in greater danger from nuclear weapons than from all the shots that we, all the diseases against which we've immunized. And if you're concerned about your daughter's life, here are some things that you can do." And they suggested writing to the congresspeople. And then they signed up the doctors of this clinic. And those kinds of things are happening. And the physicians of Russia and the physicians of America have done some consulting. And there, in Russia, there's no belief at all that the civil defense will work. There's a very popular joke going around Russia now that says, "What do you do if there's an atomic attack?" And the answer is, you put on a sheet and go slowly to the nearest cemetery. And people ask, why slowly? And the response is, so as not to create panic. And there are a whole series of jokes like that that are being passed by the
Russians. Okay. Yeah.
Because I want to respond to what you said, the fact that there are some people commenting that they would hope that a few small bombs would go off. Do you really think, first of all, that there is small bombs being built now? Second of all, can't we look to the past, to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, instead of, I would hate to have to hope that, another country would have that same kind of devastation.
I am not advocating.
No, I know, but
those bombs go off, but there are people who are so either cynical or realistic, I don't know which it is, over the ability of people to rise up, to create that kind of movement that would stop this, that they might say that it might be the only thing which stops it. Richard Falk, for example, has written very persuasively that the only times in human history when there have been really significant movements towards stopping of war have been immediately, just a few months almost, after horrendous wars, after the First World War, after the Second World War, then that stuff fades away, and the armed buildups go on and on and on again. Now, I'm personally hopeful, and I think the position for social responsibility is doing a tremendous thing for us in helping us to visualize that and realize that before it happens, so we don't have to have it there.
Do you think some of that comes from the problem that we've never experienced, or at least recently, a war on our own soil?
I think that's true.
41.
Now, the people in my parish are much more interested in the first gentleman's comments than they are these other comments. That is the economic reality of that military development. To feel persuaded that bombs to be used, of course, is to cave in. The reason that so many of my people are involved in the development of military weapons, including nuclear warheads, is because they intend that they never be used. Now, I have a lot of difficulty with that, but that is, I'm confident, the overwhelming majority opinion is going to perish. And you say it's only if public opinion changes. If my congressman is listening to these people, not to my pulpit. And it's these people's spending patterns, hiring patterns. We can go down to Pacific Car and Foundry over here in Renton. There's only one of their divisions growing, military products. You can go to the Boeing Company all over our Puget Sound area. The one area that's doing a significant amount of at least stability is their missile Minuteman connected nuclear warhead program. These are two major industries within, 200 mile radius of here. So I don't think there are any signs that the general public are interested in changing the direction the Reagan administration has set for us in this country. Now, comments about other countries in this world, I think, are, from what I understand, different, but not American.
How about the people who aren't working but are unemployed?
Yeah. Okay, in the back.
I was going to say, too, we just had that massive demonstration in New York on the 12th of June. We have almost 750,000 people saying that they're concerned about peace and disarmament. Mm-hmm. I think to say that we're not concerned is that you're not looking throughout the country. I think in places where there are these companies involved in this, there'll be self-interest, but I think that does not mean that's the whole country as a whole.
Are you holding up your hand up on the balcony? No, okay, thank you.
Okay, I got a point here. The demonstrators don't make the laws, it's the people we elect. So if you want to be effective, you got to work to elect the officials, you've got to contact your congressmen, your representatives. Those are the people that make the laws. You know, the demonstration just put on a big show, and it's a front page headline. Now, this is a personal opinion. But if you want to change the laws, and that's what we've got to get to, is the elected officials.
I think that's true, but I think, by and large, most of those people have contacted their officials, too. I mean, I don't think they're just out there demonstrating.
But the gentleman over here said, there's other people in his congregation, and there's more in our congregation. I happen to live over here in Bellevue, Washington. There's, I would guess, majority of people. I'm not even sure where I lie in this whole thing, but the majority of people I'm in contact with are very concerned about it, but yet they're a little bit paranoid and as to what's going on. They feel maybe a strong defense or a strong offense is the best defense, and that's really, you know, many people feel that way. Those are the minds you have to change.
This sounds like you're agreeing. I mean, a lot of people feel that same way.
Oh, yes.
That they have to be there in order to prevent it. I had a young woman here, back there, and then...
Up there.
And up there, okay. Were you wanting to... No, okay, then in the back, please.
Looking back at the news over the last 6 or 8 months, don't we get the impression or led by the press and the TV that war is popular and war is glamorous and defense spending is glamorous? We look at the Falkland Islands, that nightly news after the standard news show has spent a whole half hour for weeks and weeks on the progress of the Falkland Islands. I think they were very frustrated they couldn't get color TV cameras in there and take live pictures. The Israelis going into Lebanon and to get the PLO off is very, very popular. You know, and it's glamorized, and it's we're so steered and twisted by the media and the press that I think we're kind of led around by the nose that that's the popular thing to do. Look how long it took the British to take the Falkland Islands back. If they would have been stronger, they could have gone in and done it in 2 days. You know, we've got to build up our defenses to have more strength than the British have. Look how the Israelis walked in there. They were strong and they could overcome. You know, it's feeding and fueling this whole defense industrial complex argument that we have to have these monies. You see very little publicity on peace movement sentiments. You know, the protest is one day, 750,000 people. I doubt if it hardly got front page headlines. It's probably about the fourth page back. And I think the media has to be shown that the people have an interest in peace, not war.
Okay, up here.
Reacting to this gentleman and also tying in what you just said, I disagree with you about having to write to Congress people and stuff, because that is being done. I think the protests are more to inform the people, because a lot of the movement is to try and get the press, to try and get that without having a lot of money, without having people who are editors and in power of papers, you know, being able to make those decisions of where the information is. We have to protest to get the information out to the people.
And that isn't getting information.
I think that is getting information out.
No, it isn't. No, because, okay, I'm an engineer, you know, and statistics and numbers I can believe very well. But protest doesn't get that to the person. I'm just relate to the people I work with, okay? So, you know, protesting doesn't give them the guideline or the ability to make a rational decision. No, it's just a lot of people stating one position, but it doesn't give them the facts and the figures they need to make a rational decision.
But it does. I bet you we could take a poll in the group, and a number of people here would know where they're going to dock the Trident submarine base, not because they read an editorial about it, but because they read a newspaper article that said protesters were at Bangor, Washington, or Trident will land in Washington. Because of the protests, people heard about it, then people become interested and start searching. I think it's important for the people to try and get the information out through the pulpit, as the gentleman over here mentioned, but also through protests to try and get the awareness up so they do start looking for the facts and figures.
Okay. David, and then back there, we'll pick that up in a minute. Go ahead, David.
You kind of covered everything I wanted to say, but I wanted to relate to what this gentleman back here said about war giving glory. And then a basic thing that got to me was talking yesterday about dealing with nuclear weapons. You can't call it war because there is no glory to it. It's all push a button and win. That's it.
Okay, back in the back.
Well, to me, it looks like possibly the reaction to the nuclear arms race will come from the people in Europe and Britain. They're much more exposed than we are. You know, they're sitting right next to all of these tactical weapons that we've sent over there, and they're not fixed, they're mobile, so, you know, there's no place they can hide. I feel that, you know, the protests that are coming from there are speaking for the people, and hopefully they will show us their feelings and affect their governments. I look for it to come there before it'll ever come here in the United States.
Yes, sir,
back there?
Yes. Concerning our congressman, does anybody know how Congress is reacting to this movement and this toward peace? I think that they are somewhat aware. I think they are concerned. I think they are becoming a little bit aware. I don't know how much effect that it had on them, but I disagree. I think that they are taking a little bit more of an interest. And I think when people keep on, I think maybe they may respond a little bit more so.
I think you're right. I think they are attending, some of them are attending rallies, speaking at peace seminars, and I've certainly seen that increasing here in the state of Washington. But I still also follow the voting records of the congressmen and senators of the state of Washington, where I live. And certainly their voting hasn't shown any significant change. Economic votes are still military related and support of that which is military based. So my question is, I walked from Bangor to Poles Bow on the first day of the Bangor to Bethlehem walk. But I don't think that was good for me. That did a lot for my interior. But I don't think it did much to effectively speak for peace. I think we've got to find an economic weapon in an economic-oriented nation. At least the current administrative leadership is that way. Moral questions are not making any significant impact on voting records, I don't think, so I agree with your initial position. But I'd like to know if someone could propose, what are economic weapons?
Straight the spending away.
I'm sorry, your question, we're not hearing, David. Say it loud.
Straight the spending away from the military stuff.
Well, we're proposing, the church does well to propose that in South Africa, that we disinvest from companies in South Africa. What about disinvesting from like Pacific Current Foundry? Their trucks, their railroad cars.
They're not military.
They're not military. That's the only division in their company that's growing right now, that's hiring right now.
Their trucks?
No, their military products division. They build tanks and amphibious weapons.
Haven't seen any lately.
To deliver, huh?
Haven't seen any lately.
Oh, that's the only contracts they're getting right now.
Where are they building them?
They're building them Renton, California.
Renton, California?
Excuse me, Renton, Washington.
Well, I haven't seen any come out the door, and I go by it every day.
Well, that's where they're being built. They probably take them out at night.
Okay, we have two ladies in the back. Okay.
As an employee of Pacific Car.
I'm sorry, Jerry was next here. Please.
I just think that the important thing is that our society debate this issue and see that, in fact, this is a fundamental issue for the human race today. To me, that's the first step. And I think that's starting to happen. I think demonstrations are a part of that. But I agree with what the man over there said. They're not, by any means, all of that. We have to do all kinds of things. Different people are affected by different kinds of experiences. And we need to, the engineering types of people need to have the information and need to be educated. And other people need to be involved in a political movement. I think there are many ways that we should go at this, and a part of the educational effort should be focused on the economic dimensions of this, so that people realize that one of the reasons they're having our society is in trouble economically is because of the unbalance of military contracts, directly related to inflation, unemployment, to other kinds of basic dislocations in our economy. And that's it. But I don't think we should think that in a few weeks or a few days or a few months or even a few years, we're going to turn that thing around. What is important is to continue day after day, month after month, year after year, whatever we're doing, whether it's education or walking from Bangor to someplace else, that's going to take a long time to bring that about. We're in it for the duration.
Okay, way in the back, there were two ladies. All I can see is you have dark blouses on, then the lady with the red orange.
I was just
going to
clear up.
No, the ladies in the black, I'm sorry, were the ones first.
I don't know what Carol was going to say, but certainly a protest helped with ending the Vietnam War and with the civil rights movement.
Okay. Then the lady to your right.
No, I didn't have anything.
I'm sorry. All right, now the lady in the red blouse.
Just to clear the record, Civic Car and Foundry. They are not in production of any thing for the military at the moment. Everything they are doing is research and development, and they have not been awarded any contracts recently. There are proposals into the government for military spending, and believe it, I would rather be building railroad cars and trucks than tanks. That's the economics of it at the moment.
All right, thank you. Yes, Dan?
Oh, just
I'm sorry. Okay. I thought, yeah. All right. Yes?
I remember a few years back visiting the military academies, and I came away realizing they were flexing their muscle at the time. They were all thinking war, and that was before the Vietnam War. But you could feel that buildup, and that was about time when Goldwater and Johnson were talking. Goldwater was laying it out very clearly. And we heard Johnson at that time speak of Nehaha Park. We came away saying, well, he's talking war also. And of course, then we got really into the Vietnam War. So my point is that as we, a boxer or anything gets in condition, or as the military builds up its might, they feel more like triumph. When we were in Israel, we could see there the same type of thing. The country's in a position where that might be the case, but also they were building up their might at the time they were on a war footing so that you could see where it's easy for them to move out and try their strength.
Did I have the opportunity to respond?
Okay. Did I hear somebody before?
Yeah.
Okay, here and then up there.
Isn't it true, Pacific Car and Foundry, that both your truck division, your railroad car division have laid off people?
Yes,
your military products division has added people. In fact, shifted significant personnel from the other two divisions to military products.
Right, that's why I'm defensive.
Yeah, isn't that the nuts?
Yeah,
yeah.
I think it is.
That's right.
That's why I say I'd rather, much rather
absolutely
be in the railroad.
Absolutely, that's what I feel too.
Yeah.
Okay. I wonder if we're calling for nuclear disarmament, if we shouldn't call for, you know, some more first steps, if we should call for a slowing down or a halting of producing a new one, and if that is successful, maybe then disarming some, and because we're asking for a big chunk of new total nuclear disarmament. And the second thing is, I kind of view it as two issues, as military spending and nuclear spending. And I think if we're going to preserve what we all, the lifestyles that we love and know and this country that we want, that we have to maintain a military. I do not think that we have to maintain or build up and improve this nuclear warheads and so on. But I think military spending has to be. And you can't cut that out. I think that we need a military, you know, to protect what we stand for.
Mr. President, what's the difference of protecting my country and protecting what we stand for? I'm not clear about that.
Well, you're just protecting our country.
Okay, right.
Kind of funny. I'm hearing things that sound as if we've got to be taking a strategic arms limitation discussion between the United States and Russia very seriously. Remember the Salt II business didn't make it through the Senate. But if that's the sort of thing you're thinking about in terms of steps, there is a possibility, apparently, I would think, that those can be done on a bilateral basis and not simply be a step of some kind that we might take.
you're saying the SALT II could still...
It was certainly in the theme that's being talked about here as slowing growth in nuclear weapons. I keep hearing people saying, that SALT, just in despair about SALT, saying that's not the way to do it, that we've got to stop it. We can't settle for simply limiting growth.
I have a suspicion it's based on the arms race is really perpetuated by what we might call principalities and powers and unexpurgable forces that are under control. And what those forces resist is any resist to ever change the thing completely. So responding to all the pressure, I think the powers that have maybe come back with words that we would think maybe when they are doing something. By day, I mean that the whole system. And I'm suspicious that arms limitation is a code word for reshuffling the system a little so we can really just keep it going without tampering with all of the people that kind of have the interest and self-interest mechanism. I'm uncomfortable when I hear the people talking about the end of the arms race and then the administration responds by using the word arms limitation. Maybe somebody could help me on that, but I'm suspicious that that arms limitation is a code word to get us thinking that something is being done. When limitation often means just reshuffling something in one area so the whole massive out-of-control movement that benefits certain people can still keep going. Is that a prejudice or is that a...
Well, it's hard. I guess I think that's hard to tell whether that's prejudice or whether that's real. You know, as I understood the last treaty, which didn't make it through the Senate, tried to be very specific about monitoring. I tried to identify specific kinds of things that would not develop. And the main hassle over it seemed to be fears that are very much like the main negative seemed to be fears that are very much like the ones you expressed, that in this country it fears that over there, you know, they're just going to deceive us about that and get around it, around the edges. In that kind of atmosphere, it's really hard to tell what will be successful. If that's not worth a try because somebody might bamboozle us.
Yes.
So wasn't that true? We were bamboozled in SALT I? Is that not a fact?
No. According to the best facts that the government has and other groups have, there has been no significant violation of any formally signed agreement by either side. There have been certain times when one side or the other protested some action which the other was doing. And in every case, that was either cleared up to the satisfaction of the protesting side or they stopped doing whatever it was. So on terms of the agreements that have been formally signed and ratified by the United States and Russia, the limited test ban treaty, the SALT I agreement, there's another one, I think space treaty. The record is very, very good in terms of those agreements being kept. And in fact, why shouldn't it be? It's not to the advantage of either side to violate those agreements. Self-interest itself would inspire each side to stick to the spirit of that agreement, if not to the letter, especially when we know that verification techniques can detect immediately any significant violation. You know, we can see golf balls in Russia on golf course. We can read the license plates of cars parked in the Kremlin from the sky, from our satellite spy technology, and they can do the same. So there's no way significant violations could take place without being uncovered, and the whole carefully built pattern of trust would collapse if one side significantly violated. That is really false information some groups have put out, and even the government, the present government, has not accused in a serious way the Russians of significant violations of those agreements.
Do you have feelings or facts otherwise?
I read said they violated SALT I.
Can you be more specific?
Be more specific?
Can you?
Our Aviation Week is probably one of the publications I, you know, just read on that. And,
the CIA and State Department.
I'm sorry, Jerry, let me go ahead. I didn't hear him finish yet.
Oh, so, I mean, that is the one publication, and it, you know, I can't say an issue or anything. It was just my opinion that they had violated, particularly in the number of a certain, what I remember, a certain kind of missiles that they had built. The quantity had increased, you know. So that's all I know. I mean, I can't face that. It was just stuck in my mind that they had violated SALT 1.
Those accusations have been made, but they've not been made by official government groups.
I'll agree with that.
On the basis of government gathered intelligence information, they've not been made on the basis of CIA or State Department or other intelligence networks gathering information.
Yes, over here, please.
I kind of frustrates me to hear, you know, talk about who's ahead of who, and don't we kind of have to get beyond that and just look at the fact that we now have the capacity to destroy the world. What is it, every person 9 times? I mean, can't we get beyond who's ahead of who and just to realize that now we have enough, and now it's, you know, the sooner the better to stop, and, you know, we don't have to argue really about who's going to develop more, you know, when you have so much destruction available. I'd like to get beyond, people to be willing to get beyond the point of, you know, we need to make more than they make, and all that.
I hear, the issue that speaks, at least publicly, what I heard was that President Reagan was very unhappy with the protest, because he said what it did was cut away at the bargaining position of the United States. Because bargaining means you've got to have something to move. It's like playing checkers, as I hear him explain it. And if you don't have any checkers to move, you're kind of in a stalemate. I'm not, that's what I heard being said. Yes.
I heard that too, John, and I expect there was unhappiness there. I think also that one of the great things that happens because of that is an increased sensitivity to it. I think the lesson of 1968 the turning of a president out of office on an issue is never far from a serious politician's mind in these events. And even though that may be the reaction, and there may be people around that staff just and elsewhere just saying, don't they know what they're doing? I think the net result of that kind of pressure is more sensitivity.
The result of that is more sensitivity.
The result of those demonstrations is more sensitivity on the part of the White House or whoever it is, members of Congress or whatever, to the significance of the issue and the fact that there is something out there that is a threat. Not a threat to peace, but a threat to them.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Is there any validity at all to that statement by the President that it weakens the bargaining power? I don't know correctly, or in terms of the world. Or is that just a government statement? Sort of
guilt. Back there, please. Are you speaking to this one?
Another question to complement her question. We talked this afternoon of a defense budget of what, $172 billion or some such number this year, and by the end of the fourth year of Reagan's administration, it would be what, $422 billion? Weren't those the numbers that were talked about this afternoon?
Yes.
Now, I'm looking for an answer. Isn't Reagan's position that his standpoint is he wants that buildup so he can withdraw and come back in a bargaining position? Isn't that one of his edicts? Isn't that one of his presidents he wants to step?
He's never made exactly clear how those two things relate. On the one hand, he called for this very rapid buildup. On the other hand, he called for very significant reduction, and he's never quite indicated that how, if you put it together for yourself, it seems to me that implied is the idea that if we can make agreements that are acceptable to us, then we'll halt all this and start moving in the other direction.
I'm just following the checkers analogy. If we don't have any checkers to play with, it's hard to move. But if we have the checkers built up, can we afford to drop a few off the playing board and still stand a chance of coming out there with a tie or a draw?
Yeah.
there's one thing that occurs to me when we start talking about bargaining and negotiating and trying to have such a strong position that the other side kind of caves in. I'm always a little intrigued that we assume that the Soviet Union will take a look at how serious we are about building up and how serious we are about threatening them with our power. We expect that they would back down and agree to an agreement that somehow hurts their position because we frighten them so much. And what intrigues me is that we are so sure that we would never allow another country to intimidate us to the point where we would cave in. And yet, we expect that of other human beings just as idealistic about their system as we are. And I think they've up to this point demonstrated that they're willing to make far greater sacrifices socially for the sake of their defense and their strength, position of strength than we are. And I don't think we're on the right course in terms of trying to outdo them in terms of threat. They're serious. And I don't understand how we expect them to do something that we feel we would never do.
But what alternative is there? If they're willing to go the extra mile and we're not, we've already lost the whole game.
In that case, we might as well
swing the doors wide open, let them march in.
Don't, but you go back to what this woman said earlier, though, then. I mean, if being superior means that you could destroy your enemy 50 times and he can only destroy you 30 times, I mean, it doesn't mean anything. You can do things because you want to do them, not because you're forced to do them by the other side. When you reach that scale of overkill, you can say, no matter what you do, we're going to restrain ourselves at this point. And since there'd be really no motivation for them not to do the same, perhaps it would turn them the whole dynamic in the opposite direction.
I was just going to say, in response to his question, I think the alternative, exactly what Jerry has said, is simply to say that there's enough. And we should have a declaration of sufficiency, or far beyond sufficiency, which is certainly what is involved in the proposed first freeze. And the ones in Congress, that I think I haven't done too much touch with, it was the last week or so, but that is making some significant progress, that for a bilateral freeze, there are many, many people who are sincere, responsible American patriots who think we could very easily have a unilateral freeze for a period of a year or two and present the kind of challenge, instead of challenging going up, let's challenge the stock. And then to make significant challenges also, even unilateral challenges, to take steps down. And we could always go off of that and something else, but it would be very significant in stopping this continued escalation, one side following the other.
Nancy?
Yeah, I was just going to sort of open this question. Is anything worth a nuclear war?
Any what?
Anything worth a nuclear war? As I sit and think about our government and our country, probably the threat that our country says, well, we might have overtaken or, you know, power by the Soviet Union and become communist. I guess I'm wondering if that's a fate worse than a nuclear war fate.
She's raising the question of whether what would happen as a result of nuclear holocaust is worth anything.
Yeah.
Okay. Dan? I thought you had your hand up.
Oh.
Earlier. No.
Somebody wants to respond to that.
Okay. I saw a hand here and then back there and then there and there.
Well, I just dropped this out for, it sounds kind of naive, but I think we are in a profound spiritual morass, and have been for a long time, and it's getting worse. And the bomb is simply the most obvious symbol of our absurdity and despair. And when you ask the question, what's the alternative, I presume in a Christian group, we have an alternative. I presume also that we understand, as much as I love this country, this land, and my way of life here, my government, it is one of the principalities and powers which is destined to pass away. It is a part of the beast, as is Russia and as all governments are. And I think that I think the decline in our understanding of these things spiritually began with Constantine, and it's been going downhill ever since. But in the last 100 years, the spiritual morass is really serious. And if we're looking for the nuclear age, the place to look, anybody know where to look? I think the place to look is within ourselves. There's where you'll find it. That's where Thomas Merton found it. The great spiritual thinkers that we have are or are not listening to, who have given us the way, the towering prophets of our age, have said that to us. Gandhi was one who said, turn the searchlight inward. That was Gandhi's phrase. Not outward. And, you know, I my answer to your question back there is nothing. Zero. I mean, I won't try to prove that to you on the basis of statistics. Simply nothing. And
so
I
what question
that.
Is that?
Huh? Is anything worth... I mean, what kind of spiritual values are being defended by saying we can kill 200 million Russians and absorb 100 million deaths here and lay waste the northern half of the planet, probably, and make... what the hell kind of spiritual value are we talking about? I mean, that is absurd. Absurd comes from the Latin word surdus, means not hearing. No listening, no hearing. I feel very strong.
Okay, the back there?
I guess I think and hope that the major powers can continue this fairly even tug of war. But I am concerned about the Gaddafis of Libya, the Yasser Arafats. Gaddafi supposedly has a big reward out for a nuclear bomb if he can get one sold him in the black market. I think the third world powers are becoming enriched in atomic warfare and sophisticated weapons to help enhance the U.S.'s balance of payment. For one thing, it's one of our biggest export markets is defense weapons. What's our position going to be if there's a limited conflict? We might get our test battlefield in the Middle East before we know it, with Iraq and Iran, and who knows the factors to be. I think that could escalate the major powers and draw them into a whirlpool nobody will be able to get back out of before we would have a confrontation directly with the Soviet Union.
Well, I think I want to start back with the question, does the protest weaken the bargaining power? And I think it also relates to the question, is anything worth the nuclear war? It's interesting that the vocabulary assumes that we're at war with Russia. If we're at war with Russia and under attack, then trying to bargain a truce or a peace, then I suppose we could say that our willingness to give up would put the bargainers at a disadvantage. People want peace. They're ready to say, uncle, if we're at war. But in fact, I don't think we are at war with Russia, and therefore the question that the Russians may be asking, I can't read their mind, but not are we ready to surrender, which is the language we're using, but are we really serious about wanting peace? Because I think that's what... I've been doing some reading too and some listening, and it seems that a good deal of this bargaining has broken down, not because one side appears more vulnerable than the other to surrender, but it's a real question as to how serious one partner or the other is about peace. Now, if we've got 750,000 people in the United States demonstrating, saying we want peace, that should strengthen the hand of our negotiators, because they can say, do you think we're serious about wanting peace? Look at this pressure that's being put on us from home. It seems to me we get into a way of thinking, where we accept first premises, and if you accept the first premise, then all these things fall into place. And I think we need to remind ourselves that officially at least, we're not at war, therefore, it's not a threat of surrender, but the burden of proof on us or either partner that we're serious about peace. And I think that relates to this also. I haven't heard Russia threatening to invade or occupy the United States. And that's a question I've been thinking about. You know, one, just wondering, that kind of thing you wonder to yourself. is it feasible for Russia to occupy the United States? We're a pretty big country, or the Western world. And do they have the desire? And if they have the desire, do they have the means? So again, the thing better read than dead. If you ask me to decide what I'd rather be read than dead, I'm going to have difficulty saying I'd rather be read. But the question is that the threat? Is that a live threat to be read? And does that then cause me to take my mind off this peace thing? That's what I'm thinking right at the moment.
Okay. Way in the back on the side there, then over here, and then back there. Yes, sir.
Well, question a while back about bargaining chips. It seems like we do have a lot of bargaining chips, not only in what weaponry we've got, but what's being developed. And, you know, we don't know what's really being developed. Like with the space shuttle there, I forget what the percentage of the payloads are going to be military, but it seems like there must be, you know, quite a bit going to be used in space. That can be nuclear from there. It seems like we have a lot of bargaining chips that we could say, well, we're not going to use this and this and this.
Okay. Thank you. Aaron?
Well, historically, I think we can see in World War I, World War II, and others that the multinational corporations that care little about any country, but care primarily about money, have a very real effect on this whole matter of what happens in our lives. And I think some of us remember back to the Day of Pigs in 62, that era of an eyeball-to-eyeball type of thing, and other wars. And I think that's why we're here tonight, is because we're beginning to feel this is building up again. And that the jingoism is going on, and we hear talks about hitting the draft card, that type of thing. So that people now know enough where we are alarmed, and this is a place where many of the churches are becoming active. And I think with Selma and other demonstrations, they did help as part of a total picture to bring about some changes, so that we need to make ourselves heard with our Congress people in any way we can.
Thank you. Back there. Okay.
Yeah, there are a couple comments that I would like to respond to. It seems like we keep trying to ignore the fact that we have as much nuclear power as we do. We keep talking about, well, are we going to be able to match whatever new technological nuclear developments the Russians come up with? Who are we kidding? We move our point of reference to where we are now and say, well, what are they going to have that we don't have? When we keep trying to forget that we already have too much. Another comment I'd like to respond to is the comment from over here about, okay, well, let's assume for the minute that something miraculous does happen, and we do get some sort of nuclear war machine free between the United States and the Soviet Union. And then we get the third and fourth world nations coming in trying to get bigger and better bombs off the black market or from wherever. It seems that that's exactly what got us into World War II, was all the preparations for, well, if this small country, if something happens to this small country, then we should do this, and this something else happens to another small country. And so we ended up with a world war started over the assassination of a minor government official on a state visit in a very tiny country.
It was World War I.
I'm sorry. And it seems like we're just starting to get lined up to do the same thing all over again, except this time it will be like the outcome of World War II, except instead of being one race or one subgroup of people, namely the Jews, being exterminated, and those crimes against humanity, as they were called, we're going to completely eradicate the whole human species.
We have time for one more. A gentleman back there, please.
I want to divert just a little bit here and suggest, if we change our policy toward Russia and develop a foreign trade policy in which we aim dependent upon one another, do you think this in itself would help lessen the tensions between the two superpowers?
That's a good question. Perhaps to leave it with a question. I'm aware of the time. I think as a community we have responsibility to those who are following with Conklin. But I think the issue with something like this is that we're not going to solve it here. May I tell you, I think, some of the things I'm hearing floating around. Early on, I heard the question as to our really knowing where we are. I'll speak for me. I, John Muller, am struggling hard to try and understand enough to have something that I can feel both from an intellectual and a faith position. Gives me some sense of comfort. I am not there. I don't suppose that I will be there. I heard from Jerry that we're looking at the long haul, and that part of my commitment to being a citizen as well as a person of faith is that I'm going to have to keep on digging and working, because this is an issue that is not a small one. Another thing that I think I heard was that we are looking at some difference between what can be called a nuclear holocaust, which will dissolve much of what we have ever known, and the issue of peace. They may not necessarily be the same issues. Part of which is that the young man has just said is that the instruments of war have not stopped being developed. There is possible that everybody knows that the dirty mess that nuclear war will bring is that they're looking for cleaner but just as effective weapons. So that in a sense, it's the issue I'm hearing said is that maybe we have to be aware of both the issue of the unacceptability of nuclear holocaust, but at the same time, the unacceptableness of not being able to get some grip on and some sense that we are moving more towards peace than we are towards war. The last thing, I guess, I heard a little bit here, but again, the thing that has really impressed me is the issue of Roger Molander, who has written the book Ground Zero, who was with the Security Council in three administrations. His sense of it is that this whole issue of whether or not any escalation can be stopped, that is, again, that issue of World War One, that if we might get into some position like England and Argentina did in the Falklands, he's afraid that we do not. He got out of the government because he said he didn't see any mechanism in place to deal with the issue of escalation and trying to stop it from the kind of things that the almost irrational things that pull us into something. And so I'm guessing that we are beginning a conversation that we have to struggle with to keep growth in depth just for these reasons. I appreciate your participation tonight, and I hope that it does start us on continuing kind of understanding.
Thank you, John.